Welcome back to Basketball Home, your essential weekly guide to understanding the biggest stories shaping the league today.
We're covering everything from the incredible drama unfolding on the NBA hardwood all the way down to the foundational talent brewing in the college game.
Yeah, we have an incredibly dense slate today.
We really do. We're talking high stakes, off-the-court drama in Dallas, the intensifying race for the NBA Cup, and then we'll take a detailed look at the future of the league.
The 2026 mock draft class is already starting to generate some serious buzz.
It really is. And you can't ignore what's happening in Detroit.
Oh, absolutely not. The Pistons are on fire. A 13-game winning streak. That ties a franchise record.
Just unbelievable momentum. And that sets up a truly fascinating weekend of cup play, which we'll break down group by group.
We're going to give you that shortcut to being fully informed on the entire basketball ecosystem. But first, let's start with maybe the most anticipated individual return of the season.
It has to be.
It's tied to power, to legacy, and crucially, a trade that really did change two franchises forever. Anthony Davis facing the Lakers.
So Anthony Davis has been sidelined for 14 games. He's been recovering from what the team called it, you know, a standard calf strain.
Right.
And Coach Jason Kidd confirmed he looked strong after a full practice this past Wednesday. But the decision on his return date, it's been anything but simple.
Simple is the last word I would use. I mean, the fact is, Davis himself basically gave the front office an ultimatum.
He really did.
When reporters asked him, you know, do you want to return Friday against the Lakers or Saturday against the Clippers? He was so plain about it. Zero ambiguity.
He just said, you know what game I want to play.
Exactly. That's unmistakable intent, and it puts immense pressure on a franchise that's already been walking on eggshells around his health.
And that intent, it just brought all this internal conflict right to the surface in Dallas.
It really did.
What's fascinating here is how the injury saga has just exposed the front office's internal struggles. And this is all happening while the Lakers have surged with Luka in Davis's absence.
Which really proves that trade was far more beneficial for LA than a lot of people initially projected.
No question.
But the real drama is the power struggle that happened just before this return.
Mm.
According to reports, Davis had an earlier push to get back on the court, but team governor Patrick Dumont directly blocked it.
He stepped in. And that move defied both Davis's wishes and those of the former GM, Nico Harrison, who apparently believed Davis was medically ready to go.
So we should probably dive into the medical side of this, because that's what fueled Dumont's anxiety.
Yeah, a calf strain, especially for a player with Davis's history of lower body issues. It's not just a standard muscle pull.
Yeah.
It's intimately connected to the Achilles tendon. And medical professionals always warn that if you rush a calf strain back before it's at full strength, you significantly increase the risk of a catastrophic season-ending Achilles tear.
And that's exactly what Dumont was told. He consulted the director of health and performance, who gave him that exact stark warning.
So he's facing the ultimate risk management scenario.
Right. And Dumont, who has been relatively hands-off in basketball operations since taking over, he steps in and he prioritizes the long-term health of their most valuable and, let's be honest, their most fragile asset.
And the consequence of that intervention was immediate.
Yeah.
And it was severe.
Nico Harrison was fired 3 days later.
That's the key part. This is critical to understanding the hierarchy in Dallas now. It's the first time Dumont has directly intervened in basketball operations at this level.
Harrison had been lobbying for Davis's return, and his dismissal signals that Dumont is willing to defy both his GM and his star player to protect the franchise's future.
It just reveals how fragile Dallas's future really is with Davis, given his health history. And it shows that the franchise is now entirely run from the top down by ownership. Health is the absolute priority over short-term success or even player happiness.
It sets the stage perfectly. That Friday game against the Lakers is now a must-see moment.
Oh, absolutely.
And not just for the basketball. Davis facing the team that shipped him out for Luka Doncic. It's a true collision of two franchise universes. It's a definitive benchmark for both organizations. The stakes could not be higher.
Speaking of high stakes, we should pivot to the East.
Yeah, injuries are forcing teams with serious championship aspirations to get creative, starting with the Celtics. They're facing Detroit tonight, and they'll be without their starting center, Nemias Queta.
Yeah, that's a sprained left ankle he suffered Sunday against the Magic. And Queta's absence is far more than just a missing body in the rotation. He's been one of the biggest most pleasant surprises in their 9-8 start?
He's averaging career highs, right? 9.3 points and 7.9 boards. But the real deep impact is in those advanced on-off numbers.
It's staggering.
Okay, so let's break those numbers down for you, because they are. The sources say the Celtics allow 25.7 fewer points per 100 possessions when Quayta is on the court. What does a plus 17 net rating in 17 games actually mean for a team?
It means total domination when he's playing. The net rating, that's the difference between a team's offensive and defensive rating. It's the single best indicator of player impact.
And plus 17 is?
It's elite.
Yeah.
It's bordering on MVP-level production in terms of making your team dramatically better. Allowing 25.7 fewer points per 100 possessions means that when Quayta is sitting, the Celtics' defense just, it cracks.
So he's the anchor.
He's the crucial anchor. He's cleaning up mistakes, controlling the paint, and allowing their perimeter defenders to take bigger risks. Losing that kind of interior impact against a hot Detroit team is, well, it's disastrous.
Absolutely. It forces Boston into a committee approach. You're talking to Xavier Tillman, Chris Boucher, Luka Garza, and they're even calling up the rookie two-way center Amari Williams from Maine.
And they're facing Detroit's strong front court led by Jalen Duran, who will absolutely feast if Boston can't match that physicality.
This isn't just a physical test. It's a philosophical test of Boston's depth right now.
Then you look north to the Raptors. They are absolutely scorching hot. League best 8-game winning streak, 13-5 record. But they just got a major scare with RJ Barrett.
Yeah, that knee sprain. Thankfully, it wasn't a major blow. He'll be reevaluated in 1 week.
But the panic was totally understandable.
Oh, for sure. The injury happened without contact, which is the immediate signal for serious ligament damage. The collective sigh of relief across the league was palpable when the real diagnosis came in.
Dodging that disaster is huge, especially since Barrett's been playing maybe the best basketball of his career. He's averaging almost 20 points, shooting over 50% from the field. That's incredibly efficient for a wing.
So Coach Darko Rajakovic is approaching this absence with that classic coach's mindset, right? Turn adversity into a chance to test your bench.
Exactly. Deep in the roster, he's plugging Jacoby Walter into the starting spot. This forces guys who might usually only play 10 minutes to perform heavy minutes during a winning streak, which can pay huge dividends later in the season.
Let's move to the West. We've got two situations wrapped in mystery and frustration. Both show that delicate balance between injury management and team transparency.
Starting with Jonathan Kuminga of the Warriors, he's missed 6 straight games with bilateral knee tendonitis.
And the whole situation has been bizarre because of the lack of communication. It frankly sounds like an internal rift.
It really does. Initially, Coach Steve Kerr, when he was asked about Kuminga's status, he told reporters, "I have no idea what he is doing." He even suggested they ask Kuminga directly.
And then Kuminga declined to comment. That level of public miscommunication, it just signals major trouble in the relationship between the player, the coach, and the training staff.
So what's so intriguing is what's really going on. Is it frustration over playing time manifesting as a mysterious injury? Or is Kerr trying to force Kuminga to be more accountable?
Well, Kerr was initially quoted saying Kuminga was not moving well and that they needed to figure it out. If there's no structural damage, which the MRI confirmed, then the problem is either psychological or related to pain tolerance and recovery.
Which is a massive internal problem for a team trying to stay in the title conversation.
Thankfully, there was a more positive update recently. It suggests the internal strife might be resolving. Kuminga completed 3-on-3 work, he participated in practice, and is scheduled for a 5-on-5 scrimmage.
And that scrimmage is typically the final hurdle before a player is cleared to return to game action. It suggests his return is imminent and the team's ready to move past all the public drama.
Okay, let's move to Memphis. Rookie center Zach Edey's early production just hit a wall after suffering a head injury against Denver.
Yeah, he's questionable for Wednesday's game against the Pelicans due to a migraine, and that's an issue he's dealt with previously. He missed 2 games last season with similar symptoms.
Edey's early impact was substantial, though, especially after returning from ankle surgery. He was posting, 12.3 points, 9.3 rebounds, and 2 blocks over 4 games.
He had provided that interior presence Memphis desperately lacked. The team is already struggling at 6-11. They're missing Ja Morant and Brandon Clark. You just can't overstate how important that interior stability is for a team that relies on transition and generating turnovers.
Coach Tumas Isolo emphasized that Edey's absence is a huge loss. He noted his massive impact on defense, on rebounding, and how he attracts defenders inside, which generates easier outside shots for his teammates.
Yeah, when he's not there, opponents have a much easier time driving to the rim and forcing perimeter players to take tough contested shots.
And given the sensitivity around head injuries, plus the fact that migraines are a recurring issue for him, the team is expected to be extremely cautious.
Right. Even though he was spotted at practice doing basic movements like hook shots and free throws, Memphis now faces a difficult road stretch without him. It just shows how tenuous their stability is right now. If Memphis is going to salvage this season before Morant gets back, they need their healthy players, especially impact rookies like Edie, on the court consistently.
Okay, let's shift gears completely to the NBA Cup, which has finally found its rhythm and is rapidly moving into the knockout phase.
Yeah, the Lakers have secured the second spot in the knockout round, joining the Raptors in the East, with a decisive 135-118 win over the Clippers. They're 3-0 in group play.
That win was an absolute statement of intent, and it was dominated by the Lakers' big three.
Oh, completely. Luka Doncic, Austin Reeves, and LeBron James combined for an insane 99 points, 24 rebounds, and 22 assists.
Doncic specifically was phenomenal. 43 points, 13 assists, and 9 rebounds. He just narrowly missed a triple-double.
And while the quality of basketball was high, the motivation behind the intensity is pretty clear.
It's the money.
It's the money. Coach J.J. Redick was candid. He cited the $53,000 player bonus as a lot of money, which definitely provides extra incentive, especially for players on two-way or minimum contracts.
It's not just a glorified exhibition. That cash prize is making everyone play harder.
But the special cup environment also caused some controversy that we need to talk about.
Player safety.
Yeah. Exactly. Luka Doncic ripped the special Laker hardwood court used for the game. He called it dangerous due to slipping issues caused by the paint and the finish.
And this is the third year in a row we've heard players complain about these distinctive court designs. It raises a genuine question. Is the novelty of the special court design worth the risk to player health?
I mean, if the competition is meant to be high stakes and high intensity, the floor can't be this peculiar variable that leads to injuries.
It's a conflict between marketing and safety that the league needs to address, and fast.
And that competitive tension, it boiled over late in that game.
It did. Doncic got into a confrontation with Chris Dunn, which resulted in Dunn's ejection after two technicals.
Jackson Hayes also earned a technical for pushing Dunn after Dunn gave Luka what was described as a cheap shot in my back while they were waiting for a rebound.
And Doncic immediately confirmed he would cover Hayes' resulting $2,000 fine. He said, "I appreciate it. I told him right away, thanks for having my back."
That says a lot about the protective chemistry on this newly configured Lakers team.
It really does. When you see your teammates willing to take a technical and cover your back, literally, that builds championship-level trust.
So you have the high-level basketball, the player safety drama, the financial incentive, and the on-court scuffles, all wrapped up in this new tournament format.
So with the Lakers and Raptors already in, we look ahead to Wednesday and Friday to finalize the brackets. And this sets up some incredible drama.
Starting with West Group A, which features a thrilling Western Conference Finals rematch on Wednesday, exclusively on ESPN.
That's the Oklahoma City Thunder, holding a 2-0 group record, hosting the Minnesota Timberwolves, who are 2-1.
For OKC, this game is everything. A win here, followed by a win against the Suns on Friday, would likely secure them the top seed and that critical home court advantage in the quarterfinals.
Which, given the Thunder's young roster, is hugely valuable.
But the Suns are right there, also 2-0. They have a must-win situation Wednesday against Sacramento.
The pressure is immense on Phoenix.
For sure. Even if they lose to OKC on Friday, a decisive Wednesday win puts them in a strong position to advance to the knockout round, potentially as the wild card, if they finish with the best goal differential among second-place teams.
For Phoenix, the Cup offers a chance to build chemistry and win something tangible early in the season.
Over in West Group C, the Trailblazers, despite being below .500 overall, they control their own destiny at 2-1.
This is the beauty of the Cup format, isn't it? A struggling team can use this high-stakes tournament run to change their entire season narrative.
Absolutely. A victory over the Spurs, who are 1-1 on Wednesday, wins the group outright for Portland.
But if San Antonio manages to win that game, they then face the Nuggets, who are 2-1 on Friday for the crown.
And the Nuggets, obviously, they're a title contender with immense pride, but they haven't been as dominant as they could be, which makes this group C extremely unpredictable.
The Blazers have the most to gain here. A potential cup berth could inject life into their fan base and their locker room.
Moving to the East, Group B is focused squarely on Detroit.
The Magic are 3-0, but the Pistons are 2-0, and they're riding that incredible franchise record 13-game winning streak. This is one of the biggest stories in the NBA right now, period.
And this sets up an electrifying Friday matchup between those two teams. Detroit would win the group with a Friday victory, regardless of what happens in their Wednesday game against Boston.
For the Pistons, this streak is validating their entire rebuild. If they can parlay this momentum into winning their group and reaching the knockout round, it validates every coaching decision, every draft pick they've made over the last three seasons.
Finally, East Group C is tight. The Bucks at 2-0 and the Knicks at 1-1 are vying to become the first team to reach the knockout round in three straight seasons.
And the 2-1 Heat are firmly in the mix, too. That means every single game this week is essentially a playoff environment for these three teams.
Milwaukee visits Miami on Wednesday, and then New York on Friday. The critical X factor there is the status of Giannis Antetokounmpo.
Right, he's been dealing with that groin injury.
And Milwaukee has dropped four straight games without him, falling below .500 for the first time this season. His return could instantly flip the outcome of these crucial group games. If he's back at full strength, the Bucks become the immediate favorite to advance. His health is the linchpin for the entire group.
Let's shift our focus now from the urgency of the tournament to the long-term foundational debates driving the league: team tactics, player valuation, and trade market dynamics.
Let's start with tactical adjustments, specifically in New York and the curious case of Karl-Anthony Towns.
Yeah, now in his second year with the Knicks, he is struggling. His lowest overall shooting percentage since 2015 at 45% and a career low 33.7% from 3 through 16 games.
It's hard to watch because he established himself as an All-NBA player precisely because of his shooting range. But the analysis suggests he needs a fundamental temporary change.
He needs to lean into his size.
Exactly. Lean into his 7-foot, 248-pound frame and establish an interior game before stretching to the arc. If he can't hit shots from distance, he needs to generate rhythm down low.
And the data strongly supports this adjustment. It's a direct correlation. In Knicks wins, Towns averages 11.2 paint points. And subsequently, he shoots a scorching 40.7% from three.
Which suggests that when he forces defenses to respect his size down low, the three-point line opens up and his confidence follows.
But in losses, he completely regresses. He dips to just 8.7 pot points, and his three-point percentage plummets to an absolutely abysmal 21.2%. The question is, why does he stop going inside when the team is losing?
It's usually a symptom of trying to shoot yourself out of a slump, which is the worst thing an elite shooter can do when they have an established interior game.
What's truly revealing is that in losses, the 6'2" Jalen Brunson is averaging significantly more paint points than Towns 14.0.
That gap highlights the issue perfectly. Towns is settling for chucking up shots from distance while slumping, rather than using his size and getting to the rim to generate rhythm and force defenses to collapse.
So this creates a clear coaching mandate for Mike Brown: draw up more plays to get Towns closer to the basket, even if he feels uncomfortable doing it.
And if nothing else, this focus on physicality down low should help him get to the free throw line, where he's having a career best season, shooting 88.4%.
It's a simple mechanical change that could unlock the entire Knicks offense and pull him out of this slump.
Now we get into trade value debates, starting with a move that was initially panned by nearly every pundit.
The Utah Jazz swapping Colin Sexton for Yusuf Nurkic this past offseason. The Jazz were lambasted for exchanging a younger, score-first guard for an aging center.
And yet here we are. The move may be working out perfectly for the Jazz, largely because Walker Kessler suffered a season-ending injury, which thrust Nurkic into a starter's role much earlier than anticipated.
And despite being past his prime, Nurkic has put up decent numbers: 7.5 points, 9.6 rebounds, and 3.5 assists in about 25 minutes a game.
And NBA insider Jake Fisher reported that Nurkic has performed well enough that he is expected to generate significant interest from rival teams as he plays out his $19.3 million expiring contract.
This highlights a crucial point about value in the modern NBA that often flies under the radar.
It's that the specific type of player often matters more than raw age or individual scoring talent, especially when teams are gearing up for the playoffs.
Right.
Exactly. Nurkic, even with his decreased mobility, is a quality rotation big man and a unique high-post operator. He's a connector big who could facilitate offense from the elbow.
And that role is highly coveted by playoff teams who need depth at center and a secondary playmaker.
His value on an expiring deal is reportedly higher than Sexton's, who, despite his scoring potential, is viewed by the league as a score-first guard who is exploitable defensively in a high-stakes seven-game series.
Teams will specifically target Sexton in a defensive scheme, while Nurkic adds size and structure.
Shifting to the legacy conversation, reigning MVP Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is leading the Oklahoma City Thunder to the league's best record. But Nikola Jokic is forcing his way back into the narrative.
And the conversation is getting serious.
It is. Jokic is having a historic season at 30 years old. He's averaging 29.6 points, 12.8 rebounds, and 11.1 assists, while shooting incredibly efficiently, 62.6% from the field and 43.4% from three.
His combination of size, efficiency, and playmaking is nearly unprecedented. But the conversation around his legacy is heating up, maybe too fast. A former NBA finalist coach actually put Jokic in the conversation for best player in the history of the NBA.
Which is a huge claim.
A huge claim for a player with only one title and three MVPs. What criterion did that coach use that puts him ahead of, say, a five-time champion like Magic Johnson or the established GOAT conversation with Michael Jordan?
The focus is entirely on his efficiency and basketball IQ. The coach argued that no player with his size has ever combined that level of playmaking, averaging a near triple-double, with that level of shooting efficiency.
So it's the intellectual argument.
It's all about his incredible basketball IQ.
Right.
And that IQ translates not just to offensive playmaking, but also to defense. He's a good team defender who generates steals, 1 point true for his career, just by anticipating passes and rotations.
So the argument is that if you value total offensive perfection and intellectual dominance, Jokic is already approaching that tier, even if he needs more titles to solidify his status in the traditional sense.
Exactly. It's an intellectual argument that separates him from the sheer athleticism of other greats.
Yeah.
He still has time to add those titles, but the underlying numbers supporting the claim are staggering.
All right, we've hit the trade deadline watch. The Sacramento Kings are having a surprisingly rocky start at 5-13.
And that leads directly to trade rumors that suggest they are willing to listen to offers for almost everyone, except Keegan Murray and Nick Clifford.
If they do decide to sell, veteran DeMar DeRozan is the easiest and most valuable chip to move.
No doubt. He's still performing well at 18.7 points per game on 50% shooting, but the key is his contract. Next season is only partially guaranteed at $10 million. That makes him highly movable for a contending team looking for a short-term boost.
So let's run through the three most sensible trade scenarios being discussed, because they demonstrate three different motivations for trading.
First up, the LA Clippers, who are reportedly already looking into him.
This trade would be driven by desperation and necessity.
Absolutely. The Clippers are 5-12, and they owe their first-round pick, so they are firmly all in on maximizing this window.
The suggested trade is DeRozan for Bogdan Bogdanovic and Derrick Jones Jr.
This works for Sacramento because they acquire Bogdanovic as an asset to potentially flip later or integrate immediately. The biggest drawback for the Clippers is adding another older player. DeRozan is 36 to an already aged roster that needs youth and durability. They're banking entirely on DeRozan pushing them into contention right now.
Okay, next is the Golden State Warriors scenario, which is built on solving that internal dysfunction we talked about earlier.
Right, the Kuminga conundrum.
If the Warriors decide that they cannot wait on Jonathan Kuminga's development and want to maximize their win-now window, trading for DeRozan makes a lot of sense, despite his non-traditional fit in their offense.
The proposed deal sends DeMar DeRozan and Keon Ellis to Golden State in exchange for Jonathan Kuminga and Buddy Hield heading to Sacramento.
This is fascinating. For Golden State, this provides a proven win-now piece whose ability to create reliable mid-range scoring is immense. It offers a new dimension in the half court.
And for Sacramento, they get their man in Kuminga, a young, high-upside player hungry for a larger role, which aligns perfectly with their stated goal of building around young core pieces.
But this trade has to wait until Kuminga is trade-eligible in January.
Correct. And finally, the Boston Celtics scenario, which is purely about salary. It just demonstrates the complex influence of the collective bargaining agreement on decision-making.
The reports say this move is driven purely by Boston's desire to manage their salary structure and avoid the financial penalties associated with being a high-spending team.
Precisely. The Celtics are a hair over the first apron and about $12 million above the tax line. Trading Anfernee Simons, who is on an expiring $27 million deal, for DeRozan's $24 million salary helps them move closer to getting under the luxury tax and that first apron.
And for those unfamiliar with the CBA, that first apron severely restricts a team's ability to acquire players and make trades later in the season. By maneuvering below it, Boston maintains essential flexibility.
And the Kings would acquire Simons as a high-scoring asset to either flip immediately or use in a sign-and-trade later. His scoring ceiling is high, despite being streaky early in his Celtics tenure. It's a move motivated by accounting, not necessarily by optimizing on-court talent immediately.
We transition now to the college ranks, where teams are building their resumes during early tournament play and non-conference battles. The landscape is already seeing some shakeups.
Let's start with consistency. Missouri men's basketball is just rolling along, improving to a perfect 7-0 after dominating South Carolina State 98-66. They held the Bulldogs to just 37.5% shooting.
They're showing that early season consistency that suggests they are a real threat in the SEC this year.
And a team that made a massive statement on the defensive end was Indiana. They beat Kansas State 86-69.
And that victory helped them jump 7 spots to no 15 nationally in defensive efficiency on KenPom.
And that jump is huge. KenPom, for those unfamiliar, uses predictive efficiency ratings and advanced metrics to project team performance, and climbing into the top 15 defensively shows Indiana is fundamentally sound.
Their defense was absolutely suffocating.
It was. Indiana forced a remarkable 25% turnover rate against a K-State team that averaged under 20% on the season. That's just pure defensive pressure and scheme work.
And their top scorers were Reed Bailey with 21 points and Tayton Conorway adding 19 points and 2 assists. That victory proved they have enough reliable offensive talent to win even when their top draft prospects might struggle. They're relying on solid defensive execution and secondary scoring.
The Maui Invitational provided huge highlights and exposed some national contenders.
Yeah, Seton Hall registered its biggest win of the season, dominating No. 23-22 NC State 85-74. AJ Stett-McCray had 22 points.
Seton Hall trailed by only 2 at halftime, but they opened the second half with a decisive 17-2 run. The Wolfpack never got closer than 9 the rest of the way. That second half explosiveness is a great indicator of coaching adjustments and superior conditioning.
But the Pirates' run was ultimately edged by USC 83-81.
Yeah, USC rallied behind Baker Mazzara after their star player Rice left early in the second half with what looked like an upper arm or shoulder injury.
Baker Mazzara stepped up. He scored 12 points over a crucial 5-minute stretch, including a 3-pointer that finished a 10-0 run to put the Trojans ahead for good.
It's a great example of a team showing resilience and stepping up when their primary option goes down.
Then we saw a true trouncing in the Vegas finale. Syracuse was just destroyed 95-64 by number 15 Iowa State.
Syracuse was competitive. They were only down 1 point at halftime, but they were absolutely annihilated, outscored 60-30 in the second half.
Iowa State's defense was the key. They forced 19 Syracuse turnovers that translated directly into 30 points. You just can't win when you gift that many points.
And Iowa State's Milan Momcilovic had a game-high 24 points, hitting 6 of 10 shots from 3-point range. His shooting was the dagger that allowed Iowa State to pull away completely in that second half.
So beyond the box scores, we are tracking players whose performances are starting to catch the intense attention of NBA scouts.
Starting with Iowa's senior guard, Bennett Sturts.
Right. Sturts had an incredible night against Ole Miss, went off for 29 points, including 6 of 8 from beyond the arc, leading the Hawkeyes to a 74-69 win.
And he followed his coach, Ben McCollum, from Drake to Iowa, and is averaging almost 20 points through Iowa's first 4 wins. But what are scouts actually seeing in his game, beyond the numbers?
The interest isn't just because he's a high scorer. It's because he understands modern NBA movement. Sturts is a master of off-ball offense.
He's running McCollum's system perfectly.
Exactly. Using screens to get open for quick trigger threes and showcasing excellent pick-and-roll ability, which is essential for a modern NBA guard. His ability to hit those shots off movement and use smart passes when the defense collapses is what's driving him up the mock drafts.
What's also compelling about Sturts is the off-court narrative. He reportedly turned down a lot of money in the transfer portal to stay loyal to McCollum's system. He prioritized the relationship and fit over NIL temptation.
And he's reportedly prioritizing using his platform to give glory to him, God, rather than chasing personal endorsement fame. This speaks to a maturity level that NBA front offices really value when they look at potential late-round steals.
Back to the college game, LeBaron Filon Jr., the sophomore guard for number 8 Alabama, he looks primed for an All-American campaign.
The 6'4" guard is averaging elite numbers, 20.7 points, 5.7 assists, and 2.7 rebounds through 6 contests.
And Alabama's offensive philosophy is helping him shine. They shoot the 6th most 3-pointers per game in the country. This incredible floor spacing, which pulls centers out of the paint, is leading directly to their interior efficiency.
Exactly. Phelan is benefiting immensely from that spacing. He is a primary beneficiary of the wide-open driving lanes, which allows him to use his athleticism and scoring touch to post an elite 60.7 two-point percentage, ranking them in the top 30 nationally.
He's not just scoring. He's scoring efficiently and setting up his teammates within a high-powered offensive system.
All right, let's shift our focus years ahead now to the 2026 NBA mock draft, where the foundational talent is already starting to separate itself. Front offices are already dedicating significant scouting resources to these prospects.
For sure. Darren Peterson, the dynamic guard who is committed to Kansas, he's an early candidate for the consensus number one spot. His combination of size, scoring punch, and athleticism is exactly what NBA teams look for in a franchise cornerstone.
But another prospect, Wilson, who's currently playing prep school basketball, he's rapidly creating separation as a clear top five contender.
He leads the nation in box plus minus and has logged a ridiculous 24 dunks in just five games.
His motor and bounce are well documented, but the key developmental leap is his offensive complexity. He's creating easy baskets using his handle and slicing through defenses. This versatility is what scouts love.
And you see flashes of true high IQ passing and legitimate shooting range, coupled with elite defensive tools. This versatile skill set suggests he is quickly separating himself in those early top-tier discussions because he projects not just as an athletic marvel, but as a genuine two-way wing who can contribute immediately.
Then there is Pete from Arizona State. He's a prospect whose game is based on raw power and polish.
He's showing incredibly advanced footwork, touch, and strength, consistently separating himself from much bigger defenders like the 230-pound Alex Condon and the 265-pound Ruben Chinilu.
Pete relies on signature short-range fouls or athletic finishes, and he uses his body beautifully. Scouts are divided on him, though, and this is where the debate gets interesting.
Some buy the tools and the polish. They point to his production as a young player. He averaged 9.4 points, shot 60% inside the arc, and posted an impressive 9.8% block rate as a 17-year-old freshman.
But the concern is translatability to the pro game. He's listed as a 6'8" power forward with limited range, and he relies heavily on contested two-point jumpers.
In the NBA, relying on contested twos is a difficult way to make a living. If he could improve his shooting range and overall half-court creation, his defensive instincts and elite post footwork alone could make him a special NBA impact player. But that jump shot is the ceiling limiter right now.
Okay, moving into the middle of the first round, we see Chris Cenac Jr., a 6'11" power forward from Houston, projected 16th to the Oklahoma City Thunder.
Cenac is a high-floor prospect. He's productive and efficient, provides reliable minutes due to his size, athleticism at the rim, and shot-making versatility hitting fallaways from the post and rhythm threes.
He's comped to Jabari Smith Jr., which suggests he's built to be a modern scoring big.
The pathways to upside are where scouts have questions, though. He lacks defensive playmaking and passing, meaning scouts question how strongly he'll impact games if his shot isn't falling consistently.
For OKC, this pick would provide reliable size and shooting depth as they continue to refine their roster.
At pick 18, the New York Knicks are projected to take Matt Abel from North Carolina State, who draws a pro comparison to Landry Shamet.
His shooting is the primary draw, but he operates with real poise and intelligence.
He really does. He utilizes smart escape dribbles into pull-ups and makes very smart passing reads for a scoring guard. While he's mostly been a perimeter scoring specialist, his finishing shows obvious touch, which alleviates concerns about his lack of strength and explosion. He's a guy you can plug into an offense who instantly makes it smarter.
OKC potentially grabs another prospect at 26 with Caden Boozer from Duke, comped to Trey Jones.
Boozer is a player whose numbers might not jump off the page, but he demonstrates an advanced feel, unselfishness, and high IQ running the offense. This is pure floor generalship.
So scouts who value steady, reliable point guard play will appreciate his ability to make the game easier for his teammates, even if they question his lack of explosive athleticism or scoring punch for a lead guard in the NBA.
Exactly. Moving into the second round, Juke Harris, currently playing prep basketball, is projected 37th and is comped to Aaron Wiggins.
Harris has produced his way into the conversation as a 6'7" small forward. He's a serious transition weapon, a three-point threat, and a good off-ball scorer, driving, cutting, and crashing the glass.
The key for him is sustaining that level of scoring and efficiency throughout his first year in college or on the professional circuit. If he shows consistency, he moves into the first round easily.
Finally, a strong international prospect, Sergio De La Rea from Valencia, Spain, projected 39th to the Spurs, who always look for international talent. He's comped to Bogdan Bogdanovic.
He's a 6'5" shooting guard who is a knockdown three-point shooter. He hit 43.2% last year and is starting this season 18 for 34.
He also averages 3.1 assists in only 15.8 minutes, which shows obvious feel and passing IQ in ball screen situations.
His combination of size, shot making, and playmaking gives him an easy projected fit in the NBA, especially for a team like the Spurs that runs a sophisticated offensive system.
That wraps up our look into the most pressing issues in the NBA and the exciting talent pipeline in college basketball. We've seen incredible drama, from Anthony Davis demanding his way back onto the court despite front office pushback,
a move that cost his general manager his job,
to the Pistons tying a franchise record with their 13-game winning streak heading into critical cut play.
And tactically, the conversation around player value is evolving fast. We talked about how Nurkic, despite being past his prime, is expected to generate more trade interest than a score-first guard like Sexton because of his specific role as a rotational high-post big.
It just reinforces that fit, specific positional need, and contract flexibility often outweigh traditional metrics of raw scoring or youth.
Similarly, we saw the hard numbers supporting the idea that a player like Karl-Anthony Towns must use his interior game, even if he's a great outside shooter, to anchor his rhythm.
Right. When he scores more in the paint, his three-point percentage jumps from 21% up to 40%. The tactical adjustment for New York is obvious. Rhythm comes from proximity.
And the excitement of the NBA Cup is now firmly in the knockout stages. The high-stakes financial incentive of that $53,000 bonus is clearly adding tangible motivation for every player, despite some critical issues with the special court designs and player safety.
As we look ahead, the future is incredibly bright, both in the NCAA and in the upcoming draft classes. But the decisions struggling teams make right now regarding their existing veteran talent will define that future.
Which raises an important, provocative question for you, the listener. Which struggling lottery-bound team like the Sacramento Kings, who are already listening to trade offers for DeRozan, or maybe a team like the Brooklyn Nets, will be the first to truly commit to building around a young, high upside, unproven talent like Jonathan Kuminga, or an incoming prospect like Alex Saar, rather than chasing a quick fix with a veteran?
That long-term vision is always the hardest bet to make in the competitive landscape of the NBA. You have to decide to take a step back before you can take two steps forward. Thank you for joining us for another edition of Basketball Home. We'll catch you next time.